What's going on, guys? Welcome to episode 49 of the Data Driven Strength Podcast. Today, Josh and I are going to be going over his most recent training takeaway newsletter, which discusses a really hot topic kind of in the world right now, which is the whole conversation around long muscle length training for hypertrophy. And we kind of, or Josh went through the research and kind of brings up a secondary factor that often isn't discussed in the same degree of importance when that might need to be the case based on some of the research that we have. As always, if you enjoy the show, like what we do, go ahead and leave us a 5-star rating and review on your podcast platform of choice. But without further ado, let's go ahead and hop right into today's discussion. So Josh, you wrote an awesome piece this time. I really like the way that you wrote this one, like the way that I interpreted it initially when proofreading was like, I feel like it told the story really well of kind of like the way that this area of research has kind of developed and kind of the conversations along this topic online in general. And kind of the whole kind of 5,000 foot view of this area, just to summarize briefly before you kind of hop into it, right? You know, full range of motion training is important. Most recently, we've kind of had some research suggest that it may not be the full range of motion per se, but the longest muscle length that you're reaching in an exercise. But now there's this third piece of where an exercise is the most challenging that might kind of modify that relationship even more. That's kind of, again, that's from a super high level what we're going to discuss today. But Josh, I'm sure you're going to take us through some background before we kind of hop straight into it.
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty sufficient background, to be honest. You know, I think there was a meta-analysis a couple years ago. The exact year of the meta-analysis is escaping me right now. But, you know, kind of the best we could say as of a couple years ago was, you know, longer range of motion is probably better than partials. And then to that specific meta-analysis, there was a letter to the editor, and the authors on the letter to the editor were like, hey, great meta-analysis, but, you know, when you're looking at these partial range of motion studies, it seems to matter where that partial range of motion is, right? Is it more in the shortened position or more in the lengthened position? And I would say that probably around, like probably since like 2018, 2019 range, there's been kind of these like glimpses of long muscle lengths in the research and like various discussions and stuff that I've come across. But like you mentioned, probably the last, I don't know, 12 to 18 months or so, this topic has really kind of picked up steam, you know, primarily just due to a good amount of research investigating this recently. I would also refer the especially interested listener to episodes 34 and 36 that we did, where we talk about this a little bit more. So this can kind of be viewed as like, I guess, an add-on to those episodes, because the exact conclusions we have, I think specifically in episode 34, regarding the specific kind of wrinkle in this discussion we're going to be talking about today, might be a little bit different than where we were at then. But that was, you know, whatever, 15 episodes or so ago. But yeah, I think that's probably sufficient background. So I'll go ahead and kind of dive into an overview here. And as always, you know, we'll try to make this podcast a little bit different than what the actual newsletter was. Make it a little bit more casual of a discussion, mention some studies that didn't quite make it into the newsletter, et cetera. So anyway, I want to acknowledge that this is a bit of a clickbait title, in the sense that, like, you know, what exactly did we title it? We said there's more to training for hypertrophy than long muscle lengths. You know, I think at worst, some folks will kind of take the recent discussion and say that's the only thing that matters. And, you know, just any muscle that exposes, or any exercise that exposes the target muscle to the lengthened position is going to be better, full stop, than another exercise that doesn't reach the same, you know, peak muscle length. That's a bit of a straw man though, right? Obviously there's a lot more that goes into training for hypertrophy, but hopefully that was enough to kind of get people bought into another wrinkle to the story here. And specifically, that is considering the influence of the muscle length at the point of peak difficulty. So I'm trying to be pretty specific with my words here, right? In terms of how we're defining our terms, but I think that's probably the best we can do in terms of this variable I want to talk about, right? You could call it peak tension kind of more casually, but that might not totally be true. There's some considerations there. Like, what exactly do you mean by tension? You know, this might differ between individuals, between muscles, et cetera. So I think just the most accurate representation of this variable I want to talk about today is the muscle length at the point of peak difficulty. So that's basically just the point in the range of motion that's the hardest, right? And typically this is going to be where you fail. Not always, but I'd say on average, it's going to be where you fail an exercise, right? Or if you just think about the acceleration throughout the concentric phase of a lift, this is going to be the point where the acceleration is the lowest, right? Because it's the hardest to accelerate through that point, because again, it's the point of peak difficulty. And specifically, I want to talk about the muscle length at that point of peak difficulty, right? So if we take a step back and say, oh, these length and biased movements are good, right? Because they expose the target muscle to a long muscle length. But then the follow-up question that we're talking about today is, okay, but does that length and position have to be the most difficult portion of the movement? Can it just be kind of difficult? Maybe it's bad if that's the most difficult portion, et cetera. So that's kind of what we wanted to talk about today. So if we kind of work through the newsletter here, I'd encourage you to check out table one in the newsletter. It's kind of a representative table of some relatively recent studies kind of talking about this topic in general, right? The kind of range of motion and muscle length topic in general. And there's a few general trends that we see. The first is that honestly, range of motion does not appear to drive hypertrophy. Like if you have two groups, one training through a longer total range of motion and the other training through a shorter total range of motion, but the latter is being exposed to a longer muscle length, most of the time that leads to greater hypertrophy, again, in that latter group. Another general takeaway, again, just starting from a high level here, is that in studies that feature a group training through a longer muscle length, that group generally grows more, right? Again, pretty similar to what I just went over there. And then lastly, and this is where things get interesting, is studies that feature a group training at a longer muscle length at the point of peak difficulty, that group also grows more in general. But you know, those last two points I just talked about have not always been super clear up until this point in the research, right? So again, whether you just need to be exposed to that long muscle length or that the long muscle length at the point of peak difficulty, whether that's a primary variable. A good example of this is a study by Sato and colleagues, which can be found in that table. So in that study, they compared the bottom 50 degrees of a bicep curl compared to kind of the top 50 degrees of a bicep curl. So the bottom portion or the group training the bottom half of the bicep curl obviously was exposed to a longer muscle length, but the hardest part of their reps was at the top at an arm angle of 50 degrees, which is a longer muscle length than the hardest part of the other group as well that just trained the top half, because they trained from 80 to 130 degrees in terms of the arm angle. So the hardest part for them was probably at the bottom, which was only 80 degrees. So again, in a lot of these studies, the muscle length they're exposed to and the muscle length at the point of peak difficulty are often the same, right? So, you know, we couldn't really say much. We can't say much about this specific question based on a lot of the research. There is one exception though, that and this study has been around for a few years now, and that's a study by Nunez and colleagues. And they had a really, really cool design and one that was novel for a while. And that is basically comparing barbell preacher curls to cable preacher curls. So a barbell preacher curl is typically going to be hardest near the bottom when the muscle is in a more stretched position, whereas the cable preacher curl is typically going to be hardest closer to the top, so in a more shortened position for the bicep. So again, this study is awesome because you have the same muscle lengths that they're exposed to, right? The range of motion, the reps look very similar, but the point at which it's most difficult is different between the two groups. So awesome study design. And they did not find any between group differences. I believe it was plus 7% on average of growth in the group training the cable preacher curls, and plus 8% on average growth for the group training the barbell preacher curls. So this was kind of the only study we had specifically isolating our variable of the muscle length at the point of peak difficulty. And I think a lot of people just kind of said, okay, that's all we have, and it shows no difference. So it doesn't seem like that's a primary variable up until this point. And I was one of them as well. And again, I think that's for good reason. However, there's a couple other studies I want to talk about. And before I get into those, I think it's important to talk about the specific measurement that was used in that Nunez study. So in the Nunez study, they looked at, I believe it was muscle thickness, but either way, it was 50% of the way down the upper arm. So at the midpoint of the upper arm, which is a very common site to measure the biceps, and that's not good or bad. It just is what it is. And that's important to consider because a lot of other studies will look at multiple sites on the muscle. So for example, the next study I want to talk about is a study from Pedrosa and colleagues. So this one has been out for a little bit now. And I always kind of tucked it in the back of my mind for this specific concept. But again, I thought I still think the Nunez study is probably our best look at this topic. But again, I want to talk about this Pedrosa study and then talk about a more recent study and hopefully paint a pretty comprehensive picture here of these three studies that I think are the most relevant. So in the Pedrosa study, there were a lot of groups, but I just want to zoom in on two of them. So one group trained the bottom part of the leg extension, so the bottom 35 degrees of the range of motion, and another group trained the full range of motion, so that bottom 35 degrees of the range of motion plus an additional 35 degrees above that, right? And obviously, we don't see as tightly controlled of a study here in terms of the question we're talking about compared to the Nunez study. However, this study is interesting because based on the discussion, at least of the paper, the group training just the bottom portion of the leg extension trained with heavier loads. So in other words, if we think about the full range of motion group, typically in a leg extension, I assume this is the case here, they provided some supplementary materials and you could kind of see you could see what the machine they use looked like. And again, I'm going to assume that the leg extension kind of led to that full range of motion group having the point of peak difficulty at the top, so at a shorter muscle length. Compare that to the bottom, the group training just the bottom part of the leg extension, their hardest part is going to be at the top of their range of motion, which is a longer muscle length, right? And that adds up because, again, when you look at the discussion, the authors indicated that that group training just the length and partials used heavier loads. That tells us that that was indeed the case. And indeed, the group training the bottom portion of the leg extension had a point of peak difficulty at a longer muscle length, right? And indeed, what we saw is that the group training the bottom portion of the leg extension saw more growth in general. The stats were a little bit hard to kind of, pick apart on our end. They just reported percent changes and they reported a lot of sites, which is nice, right? But there were some things I would have liked to have seen that I couldn't totally get a grasp on, but I just averaged the 8 sites in terms of the percent increases in muscle thickness, or I think it was CSA in this case. But either way, I averaged the percent changes across those 8 sites. And in the full range of motion group, it was an average of 14.6% increase versus in the bottom half rep group, it was an average of 21.3% increase, right? So again, that's a study I kind of put in the back of my mind and I was like, this Nunez study is probably a little bit better, but this Pedrosa study gives us some sort of look at this question and kind of leans in the direction of, hey, when you have the point of peak difficulty at a longer muscle length, that seems that might lead to better growth, right? And then in 2022, moving on to our last study, a study by, and I believe I'm going to butcher this, it's Zabaleta, Corta and colleagues. So as of right now, it's a preprint. I posted about this study on Instagram and the lead author commented and he said, thanks for sharing. So that means I assume nothing is totally wrong or needs to be changed. But ultimately, we kind of figured that, hey, if the raw data is there in the preprint, the raw data is what the raw data is, and we can still do something with it. So ultimately, in this study, they compared incline dumbbell curls versus dumbbell preacher curls, right? And this is a really cool design because the dumbbell incline curls put you in a very lengthened position at the bottom, right? Because your shoulder is extended, which does stretch the bicep. And because your arm is hanging straight down at the bottom, the elbow joint is also in the position that leads to the bicep being the most stretch as well. So they're being exposed to arguably like the longest possible muscle length for the bicep. But that's going to, an incline dumbbell curl is going to be hardest near the top, right? About when the arm angle is at 90 degrees. So near the top. And that was compared to a dumbbell preacher curl, right? So in this case, they didn't seem to kind of go all the way to the point of full arm extension. They went to the point where their forearm was parallel with the ground, or at least that's what it sounded like based on the preprint. And because the shoulder is flexed, that's also going to shorten the bicep a little bit. So those two factors in general means that the dumbbell preacher curl group was not exposed to the same peak muscle length. However, because you know the hardest part is probably going to be when the forearm is perpendicular to gravity, which in this case is the bottom position, the point of peak difficulty is at a longer muscle length. So again, just to kind of recap, incline dumbbell curl, exposure to a very long muscle length, but the hardest part of the range of motion is at kind of a moderate muscle length. Compare that to the dumbbell preacher curl, the peak muscle length they were exposed to is moderate or pretty long, but not quite as long. But the point of peak difficulty is at a longer muscle length than the dumbbell incline curl, right? So this gives us a really nice look at this concept. And again, based on the stats they did, I don't think they reported between group differences. So I kind of just used the mean changes and the baseline standard deviations. And there were some between group effect sizes in favor of the group training the dumbbell preacher curl. So kind of pointing a vector in favor of the muscle length at the point of peak difficulty mattering for hypertrophy, even when you aren't exposed to the same peak muscle length, right? So let me pause there. And before I recap, see if Zach, you have anything to add or anything to fill in just to make sure hopefully those studies are relatively clear.
Can you explain the way that the dumbbell preacher curl was done in the Zabazlita Corta study again?
Yeah, so, and I'll be clear, again, I hope that this is like going to kind of be cleared up through peer review.
Yeah.
But my understanding of the study, and sorry, one more kind of quick note is, there were two portions of the paper where they kind of mentioned exactly how it was executed, and they kind of conflicted with each other. So again, this is my best bet. It could be wrong. We might learn more when this is published. And it sounds like it's in the process of being published right now. But I believe that, again, in a, like any other preacher curl, your shoulder is flexed on the pad, right? And instead of fully extending the elbow at the bottom, they basically just went to the point where the forearm is parallel with the floor. So for the folks just listening, as like 95% of our audience does, Zach is kind of playing around with that. But as you can tell, because the shoulder is flexed and because the arm isn't fully extended, they're not going to a fully extended arm position. So the peak muscle length isn't quite as long as the incline curl. Does that make sense, Zach?
Yeah, I'm just thinking like, so the one thing I think is important to state is that the incline curl group is still like, it's still like a moderate muscle length when it's most challenging in those repetitions. Like it's not a super short shoulder, or it's not like a super short muscle length that you could get if you were doing like a cable curl or something like that, where you're really like spider curl is this thing that comes to mind for
which,
me immediately.
Which makes the findings even more interesting.
Right. But now I'm thinking, cause I didn't realize the preacher curl group didn't go all the way down. I would say that if that's the case, then those muscle lengths are even more similar than I initially thought. And so the fact that we still saw differences may indicate this is pretty important, you know? It's just interesting.
And again, from the between group effect size, I calculated the confidence intervals that I also calculated with them. They did cross zero. So again, we'll see what they report in the published study once it's out. But it's unlikely that because my stats are, again, I figured we could do something with the stats at this point, yeah. right? But because we don't have the some of the baseline values, ideally you would run like a proper ANCOVA with the covariates accounted for. I wasn't able to totally do it the way we would want to. But we do have the percent changes. And again, that's what I kind of focused on in the newsletter. The Dumbbell Preacher Crow group grew an average of 8% when you average out the three sites that they measured, compared to 3.2% in the Dumbbell Incline Crow group. So again, if you want to take a very liberal interpretation to it, you'd say the, you know, the Dumbbell Preacher Crow group grew, you know, almost three times more. I'm not going to go around shouting that, but again, the results in my interpretation leaned pretty strongly in favor of that Dumbbell Preacher Crow group.
Just like the couple times that we've had this conversation, the reality is, regardless of the statistical approach used for this one study, once it's finally published, regardless of the findings of that study, it's probably not going to justify you turning your entire training approach upside down. What's going to be required is that, just like we've had some meta-analyses that have honed in on the exposure to a muscle length, you know, through the partial versus full range of motion literature, shout out to Milo. We're going to need, you know, multiple more studies that try to isolate this variable and eventually meta-analytically aggregate those as well. So to me, like you said, I think that, you know, for the most part, the raw data should be the raw data, unless there's a typo, of course, something like that. Yeah. So I'm not too concerned about it, but ultimately what this should do is just helps you decide what side of the fence to sit on, like once you actually go to train. But the nice thing is about this research, for the most part, is based on what we have when we look at everything. I don't think you're going to be in a, like, you're not missing out on a ton if you're kind of on the wrong side of that argument initially. If you're training with, you know, exposure to long muscle lengths, and just even using common sense, having some tension in that like relatively stretched position, you're probably going to be in a really, really good spot. Now we're just talking about, can we slightly modify how much, you know, persa hypertrophy that we're getting from kind of trying to scoot that position where it's most challenging a little bit towards that longer range. So to me, I think that ultimately, even if this, you know, the statistics on this one study changes, looking at things appropriately in terms of like what one study can do for us anyway, I think is going to lead us to the right spot anyway. So, I think it's a definitely interesting paper. This area just has more and more layers to it. It's like an onion, right? Like we just keep getting more and more questions. Like, does it matter about the muscle? Does it matter about the, you know, like in this example, like what if we, I don't know. I just have so many more questions than answers now.
Yeah. Particularly tuned in listener might be like, okay, but you mentioned that Nunez study, which arguably is like the best experimental look at this concept, and it didn't show a difference. Like, why are you guys kind of making the assumption that this variable of the muscle length at the point of peak difficulty probably does matter? And that leads me to, again, I want to kind of just quickly recap these three studies and speculate as to why that Nunez study is arguably an outlier compared to the other two. So in that Nunez study, I mentioned that they only measured bicep size halfway down the upper arm, so at that 50% site of the bicep. Whereas in the Pedrosa study, they looked at the rectus femoris as well as the vastus lateralis, and they looked at 40%, 50%, 60%, and 70% of the way down the upper leg, so eight total sites. And then in the incline curl versus preacher curl study, they looked at 50% down the upper arm, 60% down the upper arm, and 70% down the upper arm. So as you can see, there's a lot more sites in the Pedrosa and Zabaleta Corta studies, right? And particularly, there's more distal sites. So distal in this case would be closer to the knee for the quads or closer to the elbow for the biceps. And it does seem that just in general, long muscle length training, right, when you expose a muscle to a longer muscle length, seems to lead to more growth, particularly at more distal sites. And I think it's reasonable to assume that also if you increase the muscle length at the point of peak difficulty, that's also going to kind of bias those distal sites more as well. So kind of you know, the reason I wanted to write this newsletter is, okay, we had this Nunez study for a while, which is well cited to say that the muscle length at the point of peak difficulty might not be as important as simply the exposure to the point of peak difficulty. However, we can't make assumptions about what went on in those subjects in the Nunez study at the more distal sites or even the more proximal sites, right? Who knows? Because that was all that was measured. Now, someone could, you know, kind of rebuttal against that and say, well, you're just increasing the possibility of a false positive with more sites, which is true to some degree, right? And that's ultimately why any conclusions we have here are tentative. And as you said, Zach, we have more questions than answers at this point. But I think it makes intuitive sense to probably bias your training a little bit more towards having longer muscle lengths, or at least moderate to long muscle lengths at the point of peak difficulty, for a good chunk of your training, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be everything. But I think that's probably a good take home based on the research that we do have. And that leads me to a more general point about regional hypertrophy, right? In that, you know, a lot of exercise science does only look at one site in terms of muscle size measurements. And in studies that do have multiple sites, it's not uncommon for one site to have a meaningful difference between groups, but other sites that not be the case. And before we started recording this podcast, I just thought of various kind of areas of research where this regional hypertrophy phenomenon seems to be the case or seems to matter. So the first is muscle lengths, right? As we've talked about. The second is exercise selection. The third is potentially proximity to failure. There's one or two studies that come to mind there in terms of, again, closer versus further from failure groups, seeing similar hypertrophy at one site, but different hypertrophy at another site. I'm aware of a couple studies kind of in the realm of eccentric versus concentric tempo and how much time is spent in each of those phases, and also eccentric only training versus concentric only training. The reason I kind of name drop all those areas of research is that this regional hypertrophy stuff might matter, right? And it might kind of force us to rethink through some of the general takeaways that we have in the research. And it's becoming more and more common to look at multiple sites, as it's pretty dang clear that regional hypertrophy is a thing just in general. And again, there's just so much to learn because, you know, maybe 100 years from now, we can have like a beautiful periodization scheme where we just take all of these factors into account and we're able to, you know, kind of optimize things to get the most or maximal growth at every single possible site. But yeah, that's what I think is going on. I could be wrong based on additional research that comes out, but it seems like, you know, doing a good amount of your training in which the point of peak difficulty is at a relatively long muscle length. It doesn't have to be the longest possible muscle length, but a relatively long muscle length is probably going to lead to more hypertrophy on a per set basis.
Yeah, no, I think you did a good job with this. Yeah, I'm excited to see where kind of this area of research goes. I think there are so many, you know, kind of add-on questions that I have. Like, one question I have for you, Josh, this is more based on your training experience. So this is not necessarily literature informed. Let's say, you know, completely theoretically, and this is a tough example to even come up with. But let's say we have one exercise that exposes you to like a pretty short muscle length, but for in that respective range of motion, it's the most challenging at the bottom versus an exercise that exposes you to a very long muscle length, but it's the most challenging at the top of its range of motion. Which of those two do you think comes out on top?
I think the relative difference in terms of the point of peak difficulty, or I should say the amount of difficulty at the point of peak difficulty and the amount of difficulty in the rest of the range of motion matters. So I think that's might be what's kind of going on with the dumbbell incline curl, right? Like you're effectively unloaded at the bottom when your arm is just hanging there in the most lengthened position. Same idea with a dumbbell lateral raise, right? At the most lengthened position, when your arms are straight down, it's unloaded. So to answer your question, I would say, again, it just depends on what those specific exercises are. And as long as there is a good amount of tension in the lengthened position or a relatively lengthened position, I think that's going to maximize hypertrophy. But you know, if in your example, the group that's exposed to a super long muscle length, but the top is the hardest, you know, they still might grow more if the bottom still has a decent amount of tension. That would be my bet, or sorry, not tension, but difficulty. That would be my guess. And you know, hopefully this podcast can serve as idea fuel for lifters and coaches to kind of think through these multiple variables that might matter.
The challenging thing to this too is it just gets even more complicated when you start thinking about like biarticular versus monoarticular sites. I think that's also just a practical thing to consider. Like for the biceps, like you have most of the sites or the one head that doesn't cross the shoulder, to which the incline curl example doesn't really influence it, but the other one does. So it's just, there's just a lot of things. And then finally, the other thing that I just think is absolutely crucial with this is like, I still think that while looking at this first in kind of like an either or fashion is obviously how you kind of kick off the area of research, the mixed modal approaches are the ones that I find the most interesting, of like, you know, including some exercises that are exposing and relatively challenging at a long muscle length versus some that expose you and are relatively challenging in like the shortest muscle length versus a condition that only does long muscle length training. I think that kind of would pair well with what people actually do in practice and like bodybuilders for a very long time. So I do wonder, especially if we adequately measure both proximal and distal sites, if there would be some interesting findings there. The variable resistance or the variable range of motion group in the Pedrosa study is the one that comes to mind. I can't exactly recall the hypertrophy findings there, but I think if I recall correctly, they had slightly better proximal growth than just the long muscle length training group, but I can't remember.
I'd have to look closer because I didn't really isolate those two. But I would say like if you had to choose one group from that study, if I recall correctly, it'd be the group that trained the bottom portion, mm-hmm. like just the bottom portion for some sets and just the top portion for some sets. And yeah, I'd say in practice that probably makes the most sense just conceptually. You know, the more we kind of learn about this stuff, the more I think of like, you know, you think of when you're programming, okay, how many sets of biceps am I doing? But I'm almost starting to think of it as like, how many sets of biceps that are overloaded in this muscle length versus this muscle length are we doing, right? I think there's some factors there that allow you to get more total volume done, right? Like after you do four sets of a dumbbell preacher curl where it's pretty dang hard in that lengthened position, and then you do like a cable curl where you kind of have it rigged up so that it's hard at the top, it's those sets start to feel productive again once you kind of switch exercises. Mm-hmm. Same idea with just like placement throughout the week, right? If you're training biceps four times a week, maybe that means you're going to have to train biceps on back-to-back days. Maybe you do a shortened bias on one day and then kind of a lengthened bias on another day. Anecdotally, that seems to, you know, lead to less kind of fatigue overlap between those 2 days. So I'm definitely not saying to not do any kind of like short and overloaded work or shortened partials, because I think they definitely have their place. But it probably shouldn't be the bulk of your training. And I would have to imagine that a mixed approach would be best for maximizing hypertrophy of all sites, right? You can almost think of like each site of the muscle as having an inverted U relationship with training volume and hypertrophy, right? So if you do a bunch of, lengthened overloaded movements, maybe the middle and the distal portions of the muscle kind of get to their peak of the inverted U, right? If you do more work, you're not really going to get much more out of it. But then you do some short and overloaded stuff. Okay, maybe those proximal regions get a little bit more love and they're still kind of climbing up that inverted U and they're benefiting from the additional sets. So you can almost think of, again, instead of just thinking about biceps in general, you think about like the portion of the range of motion or the muscle length that's overloaded, and subsequently the region of the muscle that's most challenged as having its own kind of inverted U relationship. And thus a mixed approach is probably going to be best.
The thing I'm just thinking of now, and you know this area of research better than I do, I've been a long time since I've looked at this, but if I recall correctly, the multi-joint versus multi-joint plus single joint studies kind of say that single joint exercises may not be totally needed to maximize hypertrophy. I very well could be wrong about that.
But ultimately, we'd have to get an assist from Jake on that one.
Yeah, it's been a while. Let's just theoretically say that is the case. I don't know if it is, like I said, but it makes it hard to square the circle of like, it doesn't really matter if I do rows or rows and bicep curls, but it does matter if I try to isolate the certain part of the range of motion doing a bicep curl to grow one. So, you know what I mean? It's kind of a weird, weird kind of concept to balance there.
What sites are they measuring in those studies? You know?
No, for sure. It's a great point. Like there's different, different things they can. So the last question you have on here that I find interesting is the question about, you know, providing kind of maximal resistance throughout the entire range of motion. Once again, to my knowledge, do not know this area of research very well, but there are quite a few studies that try to do that with like different, you know, pulley systems or what have you. What do you think about that? Is it the same kind of situation here? If we're not measuring regional sites, the studies are kind of limited in what we can conclude, et cetera. Is, you know, some sort of like accommodating resistance like that the way to go for hypertrophy?
I'm not aware of a ton of research on that, unless you're thinking of an area that I'm just, that's not really coming to mind.
There's like, it's like some weird, like variable resistant things that people have like rigged up that are like kind of trying to match the strength and resistance curve. Now that might not be exactly like what you're saying. Relevant
to flywheel training maybe?
No, it's different than that, but kind of ish. But
that, I mean, if that stuff exists, I'd love to dive into it to see if it's related. Cause that's something I kind of had down as something we could talk about is like, theoretically, would it be optimal to perfectly match the resistance curve to the strength curve? So in other words, the point of peak difficulty is not just at the length end of the shortened position, but instead it's everywhere. Is that going to lead to more growth on a per set basis? I would hypothesize that it would. However, a consideration there is that if in general training at a long muscle length, all things kind of held equal, training through a longer muscle length leads to more growth, then by having a ton of fatigue going into that portion of the range of motion because you just grinded through the shortened portion of the range of motion, that might kind of limit how much you can get out of the lengthened position once you get back there later in the set. But from a high level, I think that would make a decent amount of sense. Would that actually play out in practice? I'm not totally sure. And there's probably a point where it's like, it doesn't have to be perfectly matched in terms of the resistance and the strength curve, but as long as there's a decent amount of tension throughout the entire range of motion, I have to believe that would be better than completely unloading some portions of the range of motion. What do you think, Zach?
Yes, I tend to agree. Here's one paper I found. I'm just going to pop it over to you on the outline here. You can just briefly take a look at it. But yeah, I mean, like just conceptually, I think it kind of, you know, it seems like it would be the case, just kind of thinking about it from like a training experience perspective of like, you know, if you could provide a maximal stimulus throughout the entire range of motion, that's probably going to be more productive at, you know, uniform growth. The question would be, and I've heard this argument kind of propagated, I'm not sure if I totally agree with it, but I can at least see where people are coming from in the sense that if, you know, training at long muscle lengths is indeed, or training at long muscle lengths and also where it's like the most challenging there is like substantially more hypertrophic, then you're kind of quote unquote wasting fatigue on the part of the range of motion that's considerably less productive. And so maybe the fact that the strength curve drops off in that position is actually a benefit in a weird way. But I don't know if I actually think that is the case, I've heard that argument at least, but you know, if I'm just going purely off like training myself, I would theoretically think if you could match the strength and resistance curve really well, and it's pretty challenging throughout the entire thing. And maybe it was slightly biased towards the kind of the bottom end of the range of motion, but like it's considerably smoother than like, you know, most exercises are. I would tend to think that would probably be more beneficial. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it might be helpful to wrap up by talking about some potential applications of this concept, right? Again, it seems that having the point of peak difficulty being at a relatively long position is probably a smart idea as like your default as the bulk of your training. Again, we'd definitely be proponents of kind of having various muscle lengths that are overloaded within a training week, within a training program. But for, again, the bulk of your training, that's probably a good way to go. So at the bottom of the newsletter, I dropped four examples of this. So the first is a cable curl facing away from the weight stack. And you're basically far enough away from the cable stack so that it's pulling you back a little bit in that bottom position. So if you just do this, but the cable's pulling you straight down at the bottom, you're probably not getting the same effect compared to if you step forward. And again, you basically have to fight against the resistance a good amount when you initiate the movement in that more lengthened position. Compare that to the dumbbell incline curls, similar to the study that we talked about in that bottom position, right? Obviously gravity is just pushing you straight down. So in that very bottom position, there's not a ton of resistance to kind of overcome. So I would hypothesize that would lead to more muscle growth in the cables versus the dumbbells. Another example, and this one has become pretty popular, is cable lateral raises over dumbbell lateral raises, right? Especially if you set the cables at around like shin or knee height, even as high as like, completely level with where your hand is at the bottom. So it's really hard to get it going at the longest muscle length at the bottom. Quick anecdote here for me, when I kind of switched over from doing like 15 sets a week of dumbbell lateral raises to like 6 to 10 sets a week of cable lateral raises, I saw probably the most noticeable lateral delt growth I've seen in my training career. So take that for what it's worth. Another example I have here is a leg extension. I've seen some leg extensions that kind of have a cable and effectively pull you straight back at the bottom. So again, that bottom position, that more lengthened position, is more difficult. Compare that to, you know, just kind of some standard plate loaded leg extensions where it's really easy to get going at the bottom. It's effectively unloaded. And then at the top, it's really hard. It's really hard to lock out. Again, I'd hypothesize that leg extension with the cable pulling you back at the bottom would lead to more muscle growth. The last example is a little bit more vague. It's like, say you have two leg curls in your gym, right? And they both expose you to the same peak muscle length, but one of them is harder near the bottom or harder near the more stretched position. I would hypothesize that one would be more effective. Now, for me personally, I've gone against that advice because I just cannot recover from like even two moderately difficult sets of that. My hamstrings would just be sore for like 9 days. So for me, I kind of overload the more shortened position for a leg curl just because my hamstrings just get so sore from that. But most of the time, that's not the case. So if you can swing it, you know, kind of place the peak tension at that longer muscle length. Do those check out to you?
Yeah, 100%. Just contrasting our experiences once again. I'd been doing 2 to 3 sets to absolute momentary failure plus partials on the same leg extension or leg curl machine, and I'm good the next day.
Yeah. Like it's very hard for me to train my hamstrings and be able to sit down the next day without like thinking about it. That's like crazy. no matter what I do. Like right now it's Wednesday right now, and on Monday I did 2 sets of RDLs to the floor. My hamstrings are still sort of a touch. And it's pretty early in the block. So those are at like 3 RIR, and they're sort of the touch. So it's, you know, these are all considerations. I think that's important to bring up. Like, I have some folks doing bench with bands right now because I want them to bench a fourth time in the week, but their pecs or shoulders just can't tolerate it. But if you overload that top position, it doesn't seem to be quite as fatiguing in the coming days.
This is a question. Obviously our like segment lengths / leverages are considerably different. Do you think that is what underlies the kind of difference in fatigue from a given exercise, or do you think it's like something else, like biochemical or something like that? Obviously it's probably a combination of the both, but if you had to pick a predominant factor there, what do you think?
This is super like unscientific, but just generally larger people, like people that are taller and just seem to have like wider frames, kind of separate from how well trained they are and how much muscle mass they have. It just seems on average, they don't handle the same amount of the same training stress as well in terms of being able to recover from it. Yeah. So I'd have to imagine it's related to segment length to some degree.
Yeah.
And just, you know, maybe, yeah, I don't know. But that seems to be the case on average.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I would guess too. I just find it interesting that it's like, it's cross movement usually. So like, you know, super tall people that are have a hard time squatting, that kind of makes sense to me. But then like when you know, go over to other movements, like a bench press, where I don't think you're getting like a more of a stretch. If anything, I feel like you're getting less of a stretch. I'd have to think about that closer, but like that
type it's definitely not like massive. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Right. So like that to me is odd. That's odd that in one case that clearly seems like to be a mechanics issue where you're just, you know, leverages are a little bit unfavorable for squatting. But in the other case, theoretically, you would think that you're not getting as much of a stretch, so you'd be able to recover from more of it, if anything, than in the opposite direction. Yeah. But I don't know.
I have to imagine it's a combination of things. And we didn't even get into the potential mechanisms for why exposure and peak difficulty to longer muscle length might, like the potential mechanisms for why that seems to be better for hypertrophy. We didn't even get into that at all here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad we didn't, because we just don't know, right?
Yeah,
and it's probably more than one factor, similar to what you just brought up here. And ultimately, like, all this stuff is cool and all, but, you know, I think you should still, like we like to talk about, is just follow what the individual seems to respond best to and tolerates the best, because all this stuff kind of goes out the window once you have better information on that front. But this can inform your starting points, things to experiment, etc.
Cool.
Anything else to add in here?
Nope, that's it.
All right, sweet. Thank you guys for tuning in. If you're not already subscribed to the newsletter, make sure you do so. We'll link that down in the description of this podcast. We appreciate you tuning in. If you want to support what we do, like Zach said, you can leave a rating and review on Spotify and or Apple Music, and you can check out some of the stuff we offer in the description as well. All right, guys, we will see you for episode 50 in a couple weeks. Take care.